When my landlord said rent could be cheaper if we were friends with benefits, you know, I'd heard of sexual harassment in the workplace, but at home?
That is housing discrimination based on sex.
I'm legally blind. A landlord recently said that he didn't think I'd be able to take care of an apartment on my own and refused to rent to me.
That is also housing discrimination.
A real estate agent said that we'd be more comfortable living in a different neighborhood with people like us. Luckily, we know our rights. It's illegal to steer prospective homeowners away from or to certain neighborhoods based on race or national origin.
If you think you've been discriminated or have questions about your rights, contact the Fair Housing Foundation at 800-446-FAIR or also online at fhfca.org. Fair housing is your right. This is a public service message by the Fair Housing Foundation and supported by the Department of Housing and Urban Development under FHIP grant PEI FPEI 220099.
April, you are no fool, listener, for listening to this episode of LA Meekly.
What we're predicting to be maybe the greatest episode of podcasts ever made.
And this, again, is no fool. We are no fools.
Yeah.
You are no fools.
We suffer no fools.
We suffer no fools. We barely even fool around. For this is Pound Foolish, Daniel Zaffron.
This is Tomfoolery, Greg Gonzalez. Is that what you said?
Is Pound Foolish, who's Pound Foolish? Pennywise and Pound Foolish. Oh, you have the thing.
I'd have the thing.
Greg's holding a fidget toy that I gave him a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. 1 month ago.
1 month ago, yeah, because I couldn't stop playing with something and you yelled at me like I was your cat.
Off mic, you were like, hey, do you mind if I fidget with something while we're recording? And you took out two cymbals and we're smashing them together like a wind-up monkey.
I am nervous. Is it okay if I smoke 90 cigarettes?
I have this nervous tick where I press the stop record button at the most climactic moment. Is that okay?
Is that cool with everybody?
But anyway, who's Pound Foolish?
How do you see the glass half empty or the glass half full?
The glass is pounding me. Is this what you wanted me to say? Where are you going with this?
Full and full is what I'm going for.
Oh, Pound Foolish. But it's April Fool's Day.
Yeah, April Fool's Everybody. Day.
April Fool's. We were joking. We were satiated this whole time. Happy April Fool's, everybody.
I couldn't have another bite. I couldn't have another bite of March.
And that, yeah. I've had 31 servings of March. Please.
Please.
Je suis repu.
April Fool's, please.
April Fool's.
April Fool's.
Yes. Yeah, so welcome into April Fool's, where for the rest of the month, if you're thinking of having just a little bit more, think about your April Fool this month. But
yes,
before we go any further, we were talking about something that happened last month.
We were.
All of you who haven't been following religiously my bank account do not know, which I know most of you know my routing number. Because
most of you are watching my transactions on Venmo and wondering why emergency hospitals are getting so much money.
I learned, I'm Venmoing the vet. Vetmo.
What's the last 4-year phone number?
Oh, aren't you guys full of my money already? April Fool's. I learned to private all transactions on Venmo.
Like, I don't need people.
It's like I'll open up Venmo to send you, let's just say, hush money.
Yeah.
And I see like this person gave this person for dirty toilet paper. Like it's like, I don't want to know what you are spending your money on.
There's no reason there should be a comment section on Venmo.
It's so weird. Spending money should not be social.
I'm so embarrassed by paying for food and having everyone in my life see that I've given someone $40 for dinner.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Oh, geez.
Someone should take April Fool to heart.
Should I eat at home?
$40 dinner.
We have $40 at home.
Could you have eaten $40 worth of food at home? Yeah. So last month, Phantom wasn't here because he had to have emergency surgery because he swallowed some foam and it blocked his intestines.
Yeah.
As of the last recording, he was done with surgery, but he was still being held in the hospital. Since then, it was 2 weeks of watching a cat to make sure it doesn't jump 24/7.
Which, by the way, cats are designed to jump.
They are
springs with hearts and claws.
When they gave me the like post-op instructions, I felt like I was reading a Greek myth of like, you're asking me to do the, you're, this this is pound foolish. How am I possibly? But it, so it was 2 weeks of that. And then he was ready to come out of the cone. His recovery of being monitored was over. We took him off. 2 minutes later, he then chewed off the strap of a face mask and swallowed it. And then we had to go back to the emergency vet.
This is how he protests. This is how mad I am at you guys for everything you put me through.
I want the cone back.
I want the cone back. How dare you? So I was happy with cone.
So we were afraid. It was a nightmare. Yeah. It was pure hell because I thought he's going to need surgery again. And it was almost going to happen. But we said, let's see if he passes it.
Yeah.
So then a couple days of digging through his feces, mm-hmm. he passed it on his own and everything.
It's crazy because you'd always been doing that, digging through his feces. And now it had a purpose.
I found something.
Yeah. Not just for sustenance now.
Yeah, so he is, you know, until he strikes again, he's doing fine.
Okay.
He's not here right now because we're not recording in my apartment. I swear he's fine.
Because you and him had a fight and yeah, I just can't.
He kicked me out.
I'm in the doghouse. He's in the cat house.
And the cat house is good. The doghouse is good too.
You want to be in the cat house.
Yeah, there's a bunch of dogs here. Pretty good. The doghouse was full for April Fools. So, Phantom's okay.
Good.
I know a lot of people were worried about Phantom, but he's up to his old tricks.
Yep.
Traumatized, as we all are, but he's got a shaved tummy. He's got a shaved arm. Mm-hmm. He looks like he's wearing a pelt, like a cat pelt,
yeah.
And also one Michael Jackson glove mm-hmm. on his arm.
You saw me a picture. It was pretty cool. It made me think he was like Han Solo, because Han Solo wears gloves.
He does wear gloves, doesn't he?
He does. It's pretty cool. You're right.
So now before we get into this month's episode, let's talk about something we did in the munch of March.
March munchness
and then April full because you munch so much during March. What'd you do in munch?
As everyone's at work was like, what are you doing tonight? And I said, and I have to get the whole story. I can't just say I'm taking a walk with my best friend. I have to be like, okay, so we used to do stand-up together. Now we'd sign up at 5:30 and we wouldn't go on until like maybe 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
So there was like a 3.5 hour gap where we just walk around and we'd be so stressed out.
Yeah.
And we get so bitter and impatient and petulant. And we decided, what if we just cut the comedy out and then took the walk and left
the part of it that we liked?
Yeah. The part of it. Yeah. Turned out what we want to do is walk around neighborhoods that we don't live in. So you and I have been taking walks.
Night walks. Because we both realized pretty much the only times we see each other is in front of a microphone covering half of our faces.
Yeah.
So we're making a point to, oh no, this isn't a job, Greg. You work a day in your life. You eat fish. You know the saying, April Fools. But we wanted to make a point to go on more walks.
Yeah.
And where did we walk?
And we walked around a certain area and we walked in front of a certain house where there was a story about a man named Brady.
Okay. Wait, I think I've heard this one.
Yeah.
What happened to his wife?
Had three boys of his own. She was murdered.
Who had a very mutilated wife.
It was the one-armed man. He told the cops.
And that's how we became the H.H. Holmes. The H.H. Holmes mansion. The H.H. Holmes.
The bunk beds in the gas chamber. We were walking around. What is that? Toluca Lake?
Marsha. No, it's not Toluca Lake. It's Studio City.
Okay.
I call it Little Tahunga Village. It's Tahunga, but there's like all... There's the restaurant where Robert Blake had dinner once.
Right. Vitello's. There's the cafe where we went to one time and had a good...
What is that place? Aroma.
Aroma Cafe. Aroma Cafe.
Where I saw Wednesday Addams.
Right.
There's the British candy store that walked into. We walked in there. I had a mask on.
Yeah.
She immediately said to me, are you sick? And you immediately said to her, no, he's ugly. And then that was the mask that later, or the next morning, Phantom then chewed off.
Wow, I cursed the mask. Yeah, you're blaming me and you're asking for money.
I should have worn my Jim Carrey mask. The green one, of course. Not the Grinch. He plays a lot of green characters.
He does.
Anyway.
For such a blue guy, he plays a lot of green characters. So we walked in and you showed me the Brady Bunch house. That was very nice.
It's a nice little neighborhood. And I mean, we knew it was the Brady Bunch house, but I made you pull up a picture of the Brady Bunch house.
Yeah, because you had so many questions about, and you brought me there and you're like, this isn't it. And you walked me to it and showed it to me, and I agreed.
In one of the pictures, there was like a fence or like...
Yeah, and a window that wasn't there before. And there is not 8 people living in this house. I broke in.
I don't even think there's 0 people living in that house.
There's -1. There's a ghost in there.
This house is not April Fool. That's what we said when we had our Nixon masks on when we barged in. April empty?
Yeah. September? Except empty. Except empty.
But yeah, that's a nice little neighborhood, and it's fun to see the Brady Bunch house.
Yeah, it's very nice.
I like seeing, there's a few, there's actually another, well, but that house, it was the Malcolm in the Middle house near there.
Oh, that was around there? I thought it was around here.
No,
they would never.
The Malcolms. The Middles would not live in Granada Hills. They only live in Studio City, but it's nearby there, but it's been torn down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Brady Bunch house. That was fun.
Yeah, it was very fun.
Well, you want to hear what I did?
Yeah, what you did.
Here's what I did. I went to this place. It's called the Eagle Rock Emergency Vet. again,
yeah.
It's called the Wildlife Learning and Conservation Center in Sylmar. Have you been there?
No.
It's not Shambhala. Shambhala is further north.
Okay, yeah.
But it's in Sylmar, which is, it's like the north part of Sylmar.
In the hills, right?
Below the hills. Okay. The foot of the hills.
The foothills, if you would.
Yeah. And it's a animal center where they have a bunch of rescued animals that they... that live there. Okay. They're like, they're either...
They have to pay rent.
Just an apartment complex.
It's a studio.
This is another day in Sylmar. These are all animals who, like, they had a couple bald eagles, like huge bald eagles that had, I forget why they were there. They had like broken their wings or something, or some, they hit something. I don't know. Or they got into a fight with Uncle Sam. I don't know. But they like, these are all animals that couldn't survive in the wild.
Okay.
So they're all there. They had bald eagles. They had bobcats. They had servals. They had a giraffe.
There's a giraffe in Sylmar. That alone is enough to catch my capture my attention.
And there's an owl that's blind and it has like stars for eyes. It's a cartoon. It's Mr. Owl.
Describing an anime now.
This is where Mr. Owl went to retire. Yeah, they give you the stories. There was a sloth. Like, there's a lot of, like, it's crazy that these animals are in Sylmar.
Yeah, how'd they get to Sylmar of all places?
There's a lot of, like, they gave the stories of, like, you know, some of them were pets that grew too big.
Yeah.
Like, there was an alligator that I think someone had in a bathtub somewhere in LA, and now it's a giant alligator that lives in Sylmar.
Wow.
Or they were taken illegally.
Yeah.
Like, you know, these little tiny sorts of monkeys.
Okay, yeah.
Davy Jones. And, you know, big giant snakes. Like, one of them was a giant boa constrictor that someone had as a pet. But yeah, it's a cool place. And yeah, they provide homes to animals that otherwise would have just been turned into glue or dog food. A delicious, delicious dog.
Good luck trying to get a dog to eat.
Giraffe.
Yeah.
My cat only eats serval.
That's pretty cool. And Sylmar is such a, you're right, it's such a weird place to have something like that.
And it's also one of the weirdest parts of Sylmar. Like, it's this pocket of Sylmar kind of near where the waterfall,
The
aqueduct water is.
Yeah.
Where, like, it's almost a secluded island of Sylmar blocked by the different freeways.
Weird.
So, like, you can't get to it from other parts of Sylmar. It's a really weird area.
Yeah.
But it's a fun thing. And they do special programs. You could feed the giraffe. We didn't do it, but we watched a little kid do it.
If he lives to tell the tale, then maybe I want to feed him too. If he's not too full.
That giraffe looks pretty April Fool after eating that kid. Oh, that's why the giraffe's there. It's a man-eating giraffe. But yeah, the Wildlife Learning and Conservation Center in Sylmar, I recommend it. It was fun.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm a hero for going there. So now we are done talking about Munch.
Munch.
Now it's time to talk about Full, of which I am. I ate too much DiGiorno pizza.
You did. I watched you eat it and you kept saying, I shouldn't eat this.
Yeah.
I shouldn't
But eat you didn't this. Eat enough was the problem. Yeah. That's why I ate more.
I'm trying to stay, fit. You know,
I should have taken my April. Well, it's not April yet. It's not after recording, so I couldn't say I'm April Fool.
No, we recorded this at midnight.
It's edited live by AI.
Craig, say that right. Go back and say that right.
For AI. Do it for AI.
Do it for, come on, your old pal AI.
So let's talk about what this episode is going to be. So it's spring is here. Yep. Spring is officially here. So we thought we'd do a nather spring cleaning junk drawer episode of stories that didn't quite fit into other episodes' themes that we wanted to cram in somewhere.
Yeah, and I really like these because not that I don't like sticking to a theme, but it sort of like lets me off the chain a little bit. I'm like, this doesn't fit anywhere else. Sorry.
Yeah, but I let you off the chain once and then you get hit by a car and I have to take you to this wildlife learning center.
And you lean in and I said, I promise I'll do it again.
Swear to God, I'll do it again. The second you take this cone off of me.
Immediately.
This is the mask, strap, and foam of episodes for you. You just get to go to town on all the nasty little things you shouldn't be eating.
I'm going
to
eat a little foam right now. See what you do. See how much you care about me.
See if you can keep me from jumping. So I'm going first here.
Okay.
So I don't think you know the story of either of the ones I have. So I'm pretty excited to tell you both of mine. I feel as I did both of mine, I started thinking like this could have been like the Madness of Man episode. Like that could have been the theme for another episode that we did.
I mean, we could do March Madness because mine's not madness, but it's certainly strange behavior. Let's find out. Let's talk. Rework this as we go. Editing as we go.
AI.
Yeah.
AI. Listen up. Make this into a good episode for us, okay?
And make sure it goes viral. How about that? Make sure this
podcast. I want everyone to click and share this podcast. Yeah. And also, don't forget to what happens Leave. On social media. Slide into this. I don't know what happened.
Is it cool to get banned now? Is that a thing?
Make sure that this doesn't just go viral, but that it gets our account suspended.
He's suspended. Shadow banned.
Yeah.
We're just looking for a soft shadow ban.
Any sort of attention is good. Any sort of ban is good ban. So let's get straight into mine.
Let's do it.
Here we go, Greg. Yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's weird crime spree.
You better live up to that.
Oh, I'll live up to... These are two, like, both of the stories I did, I'm very excited to tell you. So this is a story whose name alone I've had written down for years.
Okay.
Junk drawer episode. This has been sitting on the shelf in my drawer. Yeah, my drawer shelf.
Mine's a chest.
Stuart Little lives in there, so he's got shelves and everything. So
he's got a grill over. I can't.
He's got a George Foreman grill. It keeps lighting things on fire. He lights his own tail on fire, but I can't really stop it.
I like the smell.
It smells so good.
Yeah, it smells so good.
So I've never really found an episode this would have fit into. Maybe the Catalina Island one, but we all have regrets, don't we?
Yeah. The one that got away.
The one that got away. And that is Mad Jack Morgan, the pirate.
I don't know anything about this.
I have literally, I probably wrote down in my little notebook of ideas, Mad Jack Morgan in like 2015. Jeez. I probably wrote this down and I just have not found a place it would fit.
Yeah.
Or as he was birthed, Jean D. Barnett.
French?
In San Carlos, Nicaragua, to French and German parents on February 23rd, 1894.
Wow, that's a long time ago.
The year of the World's Fair, where H.H. Holmes, I just finished The Devil in the White City, so everything I think about is in context of H.H. Holmes and Daniel Burnham. Yeah.
Whoa, that's 15 years after H.H. Holmes built a castle. Everything.
Is it B-H-H or A-H-H? So in 1910, he and his parents moved to California. And then in 1912, the second he was old enough to be barely legal, he quit the land and started working on a series of boats that took him all over the world.
Okay.
He was a seaman. Today, I am no longer a boy. I am a seaman.
I'm a seaman.
Sounds fun and romantic.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was constantly being thrown in jail for petty theft. And in 1923, he is convicted of rape.
Okay.
Then, yeah, you see, like, you still like the sea so much? Then, after that, he was back at sea, in and out of prisons once more. And then, in 1931, he was convicted of rape again.
Wow. I've been on the old Pirates of the Caribbean ride. I know what, I kind of figured.
This is why they had to change
This is why.
Now women chase men. So this time also for carrying a concealed weapon and also check fraud, apparently. So he was sent to San Quentin for this.
Strange, because you landed on pirates so hard that even you telling the story down, like, they had checks back then? Oh.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's not a pirate yet. Sure, Just because you work on a boat doesn't mean you're a pirate.
You're right. I apologize.
The second you start committing crimes on the boat is when you're a pirate.
You're a pirate.
These are land crimes. He didn't go to sea jail. He didn't go to Poseidon's San Poken. Is this trident? I could do better.
Probably.
Poseidon Quentin. Poseidon.
It's almost Poseidon. Yeah.
Poseidon.
Sing Sing?
Not Folsom. He didn't go to Folsom. He went to Flounder. I don't know.
Yeah. It'll hit us tomorrow.
No, it'll be funny. This joke, time will prove this joke right. So this is the kind of guy we're talking about here. Scum of the earth, but oh wait. He was also delusional, it turned out.
No way.
While he was in prison, he somehow got it into his head that he was a descendant of the notorious pirate and rum mascot, Henry Morgan.
Okay.
So this is where the pirating begins.
Okay.
So he thought he was a descendant of Henry Morgan.
After, I'm sure a delusional person, after hearing two facts about Morgan, was like,
he had a beard? I have a beard.
I am related to this man.
He was on a boat? I was on a boat. So I don't know how or why, but this is the idea that he held on to while he was in prison. But more so than just being related, he also wanted to be like his illustrious and objectively bad person of an ancestor, Henry Morgan.
Okay.
The notorious pirate, slave trader, Henry Morgan.
Henry Morgan.
Immortalized on rum bottles. He started formulating a plan for his release. He wasn't just going to work on boats anymore. He was going to be a pirate.
Okay.
When he got out of prison. And keep in mind, this is the 1930s. And this is it, like, you know, we're, I don't even like, there was the Captain Jack Sparrow era of pirates, and then there's the Somalian era of pirates. I don't know what the middle ground was, but whatever it was, he thought he was going
to
be that.
Even like, well, I'm trying to think of what's the closest thing in that era to pirates that I know, and it's rum runners, but even that, I'm not a pirate.
No, that's just a delivery boy.
Yeah,
that's just,
exactly.
That's just Uber Eats for seafood.
Uber drinks.
Or flounder. You'll get sent straight to flounder prison for that one. It's not Sing Sing, it's whale song.
Thank you.
Yeah, there we go. So when he got we could write the Little Mermaid too.
We could write Bazooka Joe.
Bazooka Joe under the sea.
Yeah, no, Torpedo Joe. Is that something?
His underwater cousin.
Yeah.
When he got out of prison in 1937, he somehow made his way to New Orleans, where he was now going by his new pirate name to reflect his imagined connection to his imagined ancestor, Jack Morgan. So this was his new name. Kind of like how H.H. Holmes, you know, Henry Mudgett.
Herman Howard Mudgett, something like that.
Yeah, it was Henry or Herman. Who cares?
Yeah. You.
Yeah, I care a lot, actually.
You and the H.H. Holmes Historical Society.
The H.H. Holmes homeboys. We call ourselves the homeboys. So it was there that he met and seduced, in true dirtbag fashion, a 17-year-old girl named Lillian Casanova, who he convinced to cut ties with her parents and elope with him to Los Angeles, where they worked in hotels as a bellhop, and she was a chambermaid.
Okay.
So now they're in L.A. It's the 1930s. But during the evenings, Jack Morgan would prowl around the harbors of L.A. looking at the boats and hatching further details of his plan. This was how he met a man named Dwight Faulding, the owner of a hotel in Santa Barbara. He also owned a yacht docked in Wilmington named Afye.
Okay.
Afye. A-A-F-J-E. I think it's like a person's name. I looked it up. Afye.
Afye.
And she was a boat. 58 feet long, she was. A former racing boat, she was. About to be covered in crime, she was. Afye.
Scrub the crime deck.
Put the poop on the crime deck. Ah, ga, 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 ga. Ah, ga, ga, ga. I want to look through who swallowed a mask strap today. Ah, ga, 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 ga. Yes, bring me my chow.
I said walk the plank, not eat the plank. Arr, I got cat poop all over my hook.
So Faulting was rich and adventurous, but he was also dumb with money. He once tried to fly a plane after taking one lesson and immediately crashed the plane.
Uh-huh.
When Faulting caught Morgan admiring his boat, Morgan pretended that he was a rich naval officer and said he was interested in chartering the Afye for a pleasure cruise around Catalina Island.
Okay. Everything is working out just as planned.
When I started reading like what was happening, the Gilligan's Island theme song kept playing in my head. So Faulding, the rich, stupid man that he was, thought this sounded like a fun adventure. So he accepted. And on December 20th, 1937, all the main characters in this story boarded the Afye for what was meant to be a two-day pleasure cruise around Catalina Island.
Okay.
And this is the time, if I'm remembering correctly, when like Catalina Island was like the playground of the elite of Los Angeles. So they're this is all going on around the waters of Catalina
Island. I mean, if I was a pirate and there was a island full of rich movie stars, I also would like, we're going to go to Catalina.
Going to Catalina. I'm looking to parlay with Betty Grable. We, of course, had Faulding. These are all the people on the boat.
Yeah.
Faulding, but he brought with him his fiancée, Gertrude Turner, and her 8-year-old son.
Okay.
And the skipper, too. Then they called him the skipper. Then there was 19-year-old George Spurnack and 20-year-old Robert Horn, who were just some random kids that Faulding hired to help him run the ship. Then there, of course, was Lillian, his wife, who was his 17-year-old wife again, who was pregnant at the time, and her 21-year-old nurse, Elsie Burden, and then Morgan himself, who had told nobody of what he was planning to do once they hit the open seas.
Right. We were wondering why he kept staring at the island and laughing maniacally.
Just wait, Greg.
Oh, but, Jesus Christ.
What's that triangular hat sticking out of your duffel?
Did I hear a parrot in a bag somewhere?
No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Not I.
And off they went cruising around Catalina and the surrounding waters to start their two-day pleasure cruise. That night, they were all sitting around on deck having drinks. And that was when Morgan thought, it's time.
Jesus Christ.
He took.
Is there a more terrifying thing for someone in a group yeah. to say out loud? It's time.
It's time.
It's time.
The hour is nigh. He took out a gun.
Okay.
And he pointed it at Faulding and told him to get away from the wheel. Faulding told him put the gun away because he was either drunk or he'd gone mad. That was when Morgan revealed to them his belief that he was a descendant of the pirate Henry Morgan and told them all to go below deck and that, look at him, he was the captain now.
Arr, I've created a PowerPoint to explain to you my heritage.
If y'all will just sink your iPhones. Does everyone have Bluetooth on? Ah, ga, 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 ga.
I can't airdrop this to everybody. You're going to share a phone.
If you haven't updated your iOS, you might not see the graphics I've made.
Take my word for it. It's quite immersive.
Yes, immersive experience. Submersive. Faulding refused, so Morgan shot him in the shoulder and announced to everybody else, get this, the quotes I found in the newspapers from this guy, get this, you'll take orders from me or get a taste of lead. I'm in command now. This is my ship.
Cool.
Faulding tried to calm Morgan down, telling him that they're just all here for a good time. Yeah. It's a two-day pleasure cruise. It was then that Faulding lunged for his own gun, but Morgan shot him 5 times in the chest and killed him.
Wow.
His fiance, the guy who just Faulding's fiance, tried to go to his body, but Morgan said he's dead. When Captain Morgan says they're dead, they're dead. He then made Spurnak and Horn tie the corpse to an anchor and they threw it overboard.
Okay. All right. This story jumped in intensity really fast. Ha ha ha, he shot him in the shoulder. He'll get oh, it's dead. He's been tied to an anchor and he's at the bottom of the sea in front of his wife and son? Or is that other guy?
His wife and stepson.
Oh, okay.
So
you're not my dad. I don't have to be sad about your death.
How long do I have to mourn for my stepdad? By the way, this means that there is a corpse tied to a anchor somewhere between Wilmington and Santa Catalina. And this was when Mad Jack Morgan made his intentions fully clear. Now that the boat was his, they were all going to sail south and become pirates. This is what he told everyone.
I've got work tomorrow.
Not anymore, you don't. Yeah, how many sick days do you have?
Do you have any references?
Is it personal leave or is this government-covered COVID time?
So they were going to raid. This is the plan. They're going south. They were going to raid ports along Mexico for supplies along the way and then claim an island in the South Seas as his kingdom.
Okay.
The women on board were going to be his harem and the men were going to be his slaves. Doesn't that sound fun?
Guys, don't worry. I thought all about it.
Wait, you didn't let me finish. The men will be slaves.
I know I started barking like a dog when I talked about the harem. That wasn't the end of the sentence. I just want to show how enthusiastic I am about the idea.
And nobody can jump off.
Yeah.
So for the next few days, Morgan was kicking and beating all of them to do his bidding and holding them at gunpoint. He ate most of the food and left scraps for everyone else. His wife's nurse later described him as absolutely the cruelest man I ever knew and said he made erotic advances on her. His wife later said she talked him out of killing the two young men also because she pointed out that he needed them as a crew. She was not in on this plan at all, but since she was...
The baby was, though.
The baby was. It was kind of like Dune 2. Yeah. He drank the worm juice and the baby started talking. The baby made me do it.
The baby... Not the mama.
The baby who isn't in my body.
We keep coming back to this old problem and it's, you know...
How do you talk to your unborn baby?
How do you talk to your unborn baby? This millennium...
Who is the Mohadi? But yes, what was the real question?
That was it. How do you know that Paul's not the Messiah? One guy with a gun against 15 people and he manages to beat them all up. And it's kind of like, you just jump them. How about we just jump this guy and throw him overboard?
Okay, so it was two strapping young men, hot as hell. And then it three women.
One of whom is pregnant.
One of whom is pregnant. And also that's her husband. And then a 8-year-old boy.
Okay.
So it's really the two men are the ones who are probably going to do something. But also he has two guns at this point.
Okay.
So what are you going to do?
I guess so. You know, you get one, the nurse lures him in with sexual advances, clobbers over the head, we throw him overboard. The wife's like, hey, I need you over here on the poop deck.
And then the 8-year-old boy comes in and slices his Achilles tendon. Yeah. And then like does cool ninja moves.
He just breaks it. Steven Seagal style breaks his neck.
Yeah, he jumps around like Yoda. It'll be so cool. So the wife was not in on this plan, but she was the one closest to him. When he had to sleep, he gave her the gun and told her to keep watch. He said to her, here, runt, shoot the first who tries anything. Shoot them all if you have to.
Wow. Runt.
Brund. Then on the 23rd, 3 days into this, a storm hit. And by the way, they're sailing south. Like they're off the coast of Mexico at this point. A storm hit and Morgan just stood on the deck steering through it laughing maniacally.
Wow.
There's your maniacal laughter. At one point, a military plane flew over them, but he warned them all that if any of them made a distress signal, he would kill all of them. And then when the plane left, he said, one hint of anything wrong and they'd have a destroyer on my tail. Wow. Even Captain Morgan can't fight the whole American Navy. And then it was Christmas Eve.
Did you guys get me anything?
If you get me something, I won't make you a complete slave. You can just be an indentured servant.
Yeah, you get Sundays off.
It was 4 whole days of this, of Mad Jack Morgan terrorizing everyone on the boat as it got to, as they estimated, 500 miles away from Wilmington off the coast of Mexico.
Okay.
That night, in the spirit of Christ, Morgan gave them all a Christmas speech and 2 walnuts each while he ate all the rest of the walnuts.
Wow. Being pirate, it works your appetite to the bone.
It's good to be the captain. And that was when Spurnak and Horn had enough.
Okay.
They had noticed that Morgan...
Dude, I really wanted that cornbread. Everything he's done up to this point is excusable, but he ate the cornbread.
If he gave us fruitcake, I would have let it go for another... at least till the Panama Canal. They had noticed that Morgan was often nodding off on duty and was barely alert. So during one of these spells that night on Christmas Eve, the two attacked Morgan with a marlin spike and threw him bleeding overboard to be eaten by sharks. And that was the end of Captain Mad Jack Morgan. But now there was a new problem. They were 500 miles away from Wilmington and none of them really knew how to pilot a boat.
My God.
They knew the general direction they had come from. So they pointed the boat that way.
Yeah.
But then just when they thought it couldn't get any worse, on Christmas Day, another storm hit broke their sail. They still had some gas for the gas engine. So they kept heading home. But just when you thought it couldn't get any worse again, a pipe became loose in the cabin and carbon monoxide from the engine suffocated Lillian, Faulding's fiance, and the 8-year-old boy. They were all saved, but were bedridden for the rest of the voyage, which as far as any of them knew was not going to end.
No.
But meanwhile, back on land, landlubber's paradise.
Yeah.
Lillian's nurse's sister had become worried that she hadn't returned from her 2-day pleasure cruise. So she reported the boat as missing.
Okay.
This got the FBI involved. And on December 28th, after 8 days at sea, a search and rescue plane saw SOS written in Greece on their broken sail 180 miles southwest of Long Beach. A miracle that they responded.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Unbelievable that they found them. On December 29th, a tugboat came to tow them in, and on December 30th, 10 days after they left Wilmington, they were brought into Long Beach back to shore, and so ended what was said to be one of the last known cases of piracy in California.
Jeez, wow.
And just when they thought it couldn't get any worse one more time, Spurnak and Horn were immediately arrested and charged with murder on the high seas when it was discovered what happened to Jack Morgan.
Oh my God.
They had to spend the night in jail, but once the details became clear, they were released the next day.
Okay.
This story became worldwide news, and the LA Times called it the bloodiest yachting trail in SoCal history.
Why do I always title like that? The single worst day in the ocean ever made. This is what Moby Dick's about.
This is worse than what's going to happen in Pearl Harbor. So
what's going to happen in Pearl Harbor? What's going to happen in Pearl Harbor?
Nothing. We're not the LA Times. We're the Washington Post. Bye. True Detective Mysteries did a story about it, which should have been what season 2 was. But keep the crow, man. Imagine if that's what season that 2 would, of True Detective
it
was.
Would have been very short, but yeah, take it. Let's do it.
No, but you're finding they're inspecting, I guess it. Well, how much can you expect?
Yeah.
Look at the boat. Not going to go, where was the water that this took place on?
Who ate all the cornbread?
Why are these walnut shells everywhere? How come all of these corpses are frozen into a popsicle? What's Carcosa? And other questions.
And other questions. What happened to the pipe? This pipe's done broke. What happened to the sail?
Why does the pipe have a mask on it? In court later, Lillian said, I had no part in my husband's crack brain scheme. And that was pretty much the end of the story. The bodies were never found, obviously. Wow. Lillian moved back to New Orleans to reunite with her parents and never spoke publicly about this again.
Good, smart girl.
But that wasn't the end of the story for the boat. Because of the story of this, it started being considered a pirate ship, even though it was just a racing yacht.
Yeah.
And it started being called the Death Yacht. In July 1938, the boat went up for auction, described as the boat that prowled channel waters with a madman at the helm.
Oh my God.
Errol Flynn was going to buy it, but it eventually got sold to the guy who wrote the movie The Story of Seabiscuit for $7,000.
He really loves the sea.
If only he had shared his sea biscuits with the rest of the crew, maybe this wouldn't have happened. So that, which is also what I had to dig through to find the mask strap. They're all over the poop deck. Then in December 1939, the boat caught on fire in Santa Monica. In November 1940, someone stole it and crashed it into three other boats.
Is the guy who set the boat on fire the same guy who set H.H. Holmes' castle on fire?
The same mystery man. Oh, you mean the devil? H.H. Holmes' business partner, S. Aiton. The next known story of this boat was in 1970 when it was sold to Travis Ashbrook of the Brothers of Eternal Love, which was some kind of marijuana dealing hippie cult in Orange County.
Okay.
Who used the boat to sail through the Panama Canal to shuttle marijuana between Mexico and Hawaii.
Or some things never change.
And thus ends all swashbuckling tales of the high seas on a marijuana swift boat in Oahu.
The entire state of California is now that ship.
I know.
Carrying all this marijuana.
We're wafting marijuana smoke to Hawaii.
Let's go through the Panama Canal. It fits. We're a long state.
Yeah, so that's the story of Mad Captain Jack Morgan.
That was wonderful. I had no idea that was even a story.
It's so strange. And also to think like his body's out there.
Yeah.
And the other guy's body waiting for his revenge. And then, there's an epilogue to this story. There's bubbles bubbling up 500 miles off the coast of Mexico. What could it be? Natural? A fish?
Do I confuse bubbles and waves all the time?
This is Mexico's problem now. So yeah, that's Captain Mad Jack Morgan.
That's great.
Very interesting. Yeah. I love a good pirate story.
Me
and
too.
And that we have a semi-modern pirate story, 100-year-old almost pirate story.
Pretty great.
But it feels as fresh as the day it happened.
It could have happened in 2023.
Hey, you know what?
Kind of.
Yeah. I could see this happen. By the time this episode comes out, there's probably going to be some TikTok person who like murdered all these people off the coast of Catalina because he thought he was Jack Morgan's descendant.
The guy in the bottle.
So what do you have? What are you telling me about?
All right. Deep into the San Gabriel Valley, in the suburban neighborhood of Glendora, lies a folk art monument unlike any other. The work of local weirdo Michael Rubel, the 1.7-acre lot contains a small village made of junk and scraps. Some call it Rubalia, others call it Rubel Farms with a PH, farms. But it is commonly referred, I have no idea. I think because it was in the 60s, 70s, and it was just like cool to misspell like
pharmaceutical
stuff.
Pharmaceutical?
Oh, maybe.
Big
pharma. Yeah, that's what they're getting at. Some call it Rubel Farms, but it is commonly referred to as the Rubel Castle, which sits alongside in spirit to other folk art pieces like the Watchtowers or Salvation Mountain, which is more south.
What's Salvation Mountain? Is that Slab City? What's Slab City?
It might be Slab City. Salvation Mountain is some like...
Or the Mosaic Tile House in Venice.
Right, and that's another one, yeah.
Slab City, I think Slab City is like a weird little republic unto itself in the middle of the desert where like any, like there are no laws and you can do whatever you want.
Salvation Army is that one where it's painted with a bunch of stuff.
And Salvation Mountain?
Yeah, Salvation Mountain.
Salvation Army? Or Salvation Army.
What did I say?
Salvation Army.
But they live there. They protect it. Yeah.
They're like the dwarves that come out of Salvation Mountain. I think, isn't that near like the Salton Sea something?
Yeah, it's really south. And
I guess the Salton Sea must be south because people keep ending up in Mexico getting lost around there.
Yeah, so I could see that. Must be south, yeah. No, it's north. Let's talk about Michael Rubel. He was born in Glendora in 1940. His dad, Henry Scott Rubel, was a pastor of an Episcopal church, an orchardist, and a gag writer, but I couldn't find anything he wrote.
Mm.
His mother was a chorus girl. Glendora in the 50s was mostly citrus groves, but a small residential area was emerging as the citrus industry was dipping. The Rubel's home was connected to a 1,400-acre citrus ranch, which was owned by Albert Bourne, which was the president of the Singer Sewing Machine Company.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, right? The property known as El Bourne...
This weird thing, didn't the Kellogg's have something out that way?
Oh, I don't know. Probably.
Maybe, I don't know if it's the same Kellogg's, though, but how could there be more than one Kellogg's?
We would have done a Kellogg's episode already. We're running out of stuff.
We would have been eating cereal every episode if there was a Kellogg thing.
We would have been eating cereal and not masturbating.
Or
a better idea. A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
Why not combine the two?
So the property was known as Elborn Ranch.
Masterbows. Go on.
The property was known as Elborn Ranch, named after Albert Bourne, and was pretty vast. It included a reservoir for irrigating oranges and a packing house for citrus. This is where Michael grew up. You know, this was like kind of neighboring to him. So he grew up playing on this lot of land. And he would
trespassing.
And he would tell Albert Bourne that when he grew up, he was going to buy the Dalton Reservoir and the packing house.
What a threat.
Yeah. I'm gonna own you.
I'm going to put you out of home. Home and means.
You're going to live on the street.
And you know those people down the street who don't like masturbating? I'm going to buy them out too.
I'm going to buy them out.
I'm going to masturbate everywhere. Because I'm 7. And I don't know what that means.
And I'm not quite sure what that means yet, but you know what? It's around the corner.
But I know it's what happens in business meetings.
So the Rubel home was also close to the municipal dump where stray objects and materials were plentiful. Hmm. Both of these spaces would be crucial.
Where you leave your sea biscuits.
Or pieces of sea biscuits there. Both of these spaces, the Elborn Ranch and the municipal dump, would be crucial to the rest of Rubel's life. Elborn's ranch in particular was a special place for Rubel, as the grounds were something, like I said, like a playground for him. When the Borns subdivided their property, they donated 2.5 acres to the Glendora Episcopal Church, which of course included the reservoir and the citrus ranch buildings, and also, which of course, the church was Mr. Rubel was a pastor of. There was a special clause was created that would offer Michael Rubel the option to purchase the property when he turned 20.
That's weird. So yeah. The guy liked this plan?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Everybody was okay with this.
All right.
So it seems like as a teen before he bought the ranch.
You meaning he moved on to a better place? Alhambra?
Alhambra, yeah. As a teen, Rubel became a world traveler, wandering through Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, where he worked as a jackaroo, which is a cowboy.
That rides kangaroos around the outback?
Yeah. Instead of you don't ride horses, you ride kangaroos. You don't have spurs around your boots, it's spiders. Your rope tricks are just a big snake. Australia, like we all know.
You don't have a cowboy hat on, it's just the koala. Yeah, we know Australia.
Australia, like the Australia we all know and love.
You don't drink sarsaparilla, you drink de-alcoholed Fosters.
Both places are hot. I don't know why you're having a hard time understanding a jackaroo. Jackaroo and cowboy are basically the same thing.
The hole that you defecate into in the ground swirls in the other direction when there's a flash flood.
When there's a flash flood, yeah. So, like I said, he's a world traveler, sailed the high seas as well on a Spanish ship, first as a paint chipper, then as a purser, which is a...
Isn't that like the money person?
The accountant, yeah, okay. Which is really funny, but that...
And he had to carry a purse on the boat.
He had to carry a purse.
So these are both seamen.
Yeah, they're both... There's two stories of seamen. Two seamen. Yeah, two seamen out there.
Maybe we could have done a whole episode on seamen.
Who's our favorite seamen?
I think Kellogg's would not like this.
They are pulling in our endorsement. We're going to cut to a cornflakes commercial. No, we can't.
A completely unsweetened cornflake from the 1940s. We're going to cut to a commercial for that. Kids were going to love it.
It's weird that it's an anti-masturbatory cereal and the logo is a rooster. Right.
Would you prefer it was a sperm whale?
A couple rabbits would have been nice. So as, you know, as a purser, he sailed the Mediterranean, the Suez Canal, the East Indies and Japan. But now he's back home growing cucumbers and eggplants hydroponically. But he himself said that was a fiasco, that nothing went there. The captain he sailed with, who had taken him under his wing, had left him a substantial amount of money when he passed. And with the Elborn property to fall back on, at the age of 19, Michael Rubel bought the property that was being offered to him. He would spend the rest of his life serving the grounds, basically, and building upon everything that's already there. He would now focus on building his castle almost full time.
We're talking about H.H. Holmes again.
Oh, you know, I hadn't even considered that.
He had one chamber where if you press this lever.
He can now focus on building his castle almost full time, almost, except for 2 hours he worked each weekday during driving a school bus in the afternoon, delivering mountain children to their homes on a 110-mile run.
My God.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's weird.
Mountain children.
You know, Glendora is really close to the Azusa Hills or whatever. I wonder if that's, it doesn't matter.
The mountain children. Mountain children.
Yeah. It's weird. I thought I put in the notes that he, as a child, with the municipal dump really close, would build castles and structures and him all that. He would like lead the neighborhood kids in building these like really tall, he'd call them forts. I'd build a fort, but you're seeing a fort in your head. This is like the Little Rascals clubhouse. Like he would build these like really intricate, well-crafted junk houses as a child. And this is what him and all the neighborhood kids would do.
That's weird.
I should have said that. So him as an adult with money and property and his impulse is still, well, I want to build a castle out of it. So I'm going to build a castle out of it. The castle. Okay, so now we could talk about the property, the Rubel Castle. The castle is the main draw and the showstopper of Rubelia. The castle consists of
Rubelia.
Rubelia or Rubel Castle. I use castle too many times in one sentence.
Okay.
Rubelia, Rubel Farms, Rubel Castle.
Okay, so that's the name of his kingdom is Rubelia.
Rubelia is one of the terms, yeah. The castle consists of 3 or 4 buildings alongside the castle walls, 4 circular towers, and an interior courtyard space. So it's like a medieval village.
Okay.
Do you want to look it up and take a peek at what this looks like? Because I feel like it's hard for you to understand that in Glendora there is a castle. Rubel, R-U-B-E-L, castle.
Safe search off. Oh, whoa.
It's a castle. Everybody stop and search for Rubel Castle in case you're not getting what
everybody
I'm talking
stop, about. Grab a handful of cornflakes and look up Rubel Castle.
You zip up your pants, look up Rubel Castle. So the castle consists of three or four buildings along the castle walls.
It looks fuzzy.
It looks very rocky.
Yeah. Okay. This is weird.
The four circular.
It looks like it's not a miniature golf course.
When I saw it, I'm like, you could bowl there. You could play mini golf there.
H.H. Holmes could have had a lot of fun in this place.
H.H. Holmes got 50 different people that built different parts of this castle. So nobody knew really why he needed all this space in between the walls.
And then the mountain children start going missing and no one thought to look into it.
And sure, they didn't really understand how insurance scams work. And neither did H.H. Holmes, but he did it anyways. Much of the castle used the reservoir as a foundation and superimposed the stones and stream rocks pulled from the San Gabriel Canyon into the structure itself. So it's like these rocks and stones are cemented into the walls, which gives it that look.
It's like the Loomis house where he just grabbed a bunch of rocks from the Arroyo Seco. It's like, I live here now.
Yeah, and just wedged them together. It's like, yeah, well, this is my house. Deal with it. And it was like 1955 or whatever. Yeah. So construction began slowly, but officially in 1965, with the tower, the walls, and the buildings constructed over time, expanding beyond just a castle, but a whole, like I said, medieval village, which I believe measures out to like 22,000 square feet. The castle also has cool castle stuff like battlements, a drawbridge, a portcullis, which
dragon.
Is the best, a dragon. Syphilis.
A caste system. Serfs. It had everything.
Everything you could ever want. The gate itself is made of massive wood timbers, and the tunnel through the passageway is lined with glass bottles set in cement.
So it's like the watchtowers now.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, I'm sure I get to it, but like set in the walls is not just stones. It's like bottles and motorcycle parts and pieces of metal and like railroad ties. It's just like junk stuff.
Like a hermit crab.
Yeah, exactly. There's old television poles, discarded pipes, bed springs, coat hangers above everything else I already mentioned. There's like pieces of a motorcycle and bicycles sticking out. Through the seven...
It's like City Walk? Pieces of City Walk?
There's King Kong sticking out of it. It's half a car. And there used to be a Tommy's here built into the wall and it's gone now.
John Lovitz used to have a comedy club there, but not anymore.
Does he not have a comedy club in there?
I don't think the John Lovitz comedy club. I think it might be called something else. I don't know if it's comedy anymore, though, because comedy's dead.
As soon as we stopped doing it, comedy's dead. People were... Who's been laughing since we stopped? By 1972, the castle walls were three stories tall around the periphery. There are four square towers. The Pigeon Tower, which is four stories tall and once housed pigeons on the roof. The Fire Tower, which funny enough contains a water tank and pressuring pump. The Bee Tower, which once had a working beehive.
God.
And the Clock Tower, which obviously has a clock.
Wait, let me guess.
These days, the towers are rental spaces, living quarters, or workshops. But we'll get into a little bit later about who lives there. In the center of the castle complex is the machine shop or the roundhouse, which I imagine is a circular tower. Again, fitting the castle and Rubel aesthetic, rocks and scraps set in the cement decorate the walls. And the ironworks themselves are made by, there's an on-site blacksmith used, and he makes stuff like the gates and other metal pieces. I watched Hugh Hauser go there, and the video I watched was him, I want to say like in the 2010s or around there, maybe earlier than that, looking back at when he went back to the 90s and met Michael Rubel, who is everything I ever want to be. just like overalls, is like, I don't know how that happened. Hugh Hauser goes back there later and he's talking to the blacksmith. He's like, he learns the blacksmith's name. He's like, oh, are you related to the former blacksmith again? And that's his dad. And that's, it feels like how Rubel Castle works. Is like
nepotism.
But like you like, it's a little community, an art community, basically a folk art community, and everybody who has something to do with it now probably knew somebody who helped build it originally,
right? Well,
which I think is really cool.
That's Glendora.
It's Glendora, baby.
It's Glendora for everybody knows everybody in Glendora.
It's only nine people. So there's the Bottle House, which was technically the first constructed building in the reservoir and made to serve as a rest residence spot on the grounds. Rubel and the farmhands, PH Farms, built a small 8x10 place out of multicolored bottles set in cement. And when the light comes through the bottles, creates a little lovely color designs inside. And there's a small wood burning stove and sitting area inside the Bottle House.
Yeah, with the picture I looked at, I thought it was a restaurant in the middle. Like it looked like a little patio.
Like an eatery?
Yeah, an eatery.
Yeah.
How do you say... A cafe,
maybe. I don't know. There's a small shack made of railroad ties. There's a shack made out of orange crates. There's a potter shop. Rubel himself lives in the old packing house known as the Tin Palace.
Wait a minute, he's still alive?
No. I phrased that weird. When he was alive, he was living in the Tin Palace, which is the old packing house. Itself made of old sheet metal. The Tin Palace is 158 feet long, 42 feet wide, and over 7,500 square feet of floor space. because it's a packing house. The Tin Palace is well furnished, adorned with nice paintings. There's a grand piano. There's two elevators, one to the kitchen underground, the other to a wine cellar. And in the middle is a 1928 Chevy truck that he managed to get in
there. This is H.H. Holmes. You're just describing H.H. Holmes.
The car is just to get like gas inside of the house. This is like a makeshift gas chamber.
There's a pipe that goes from the exhaust to this box that we've never opened.
Just put your mouth on the pipe. The bed of the truck is an actual bed, by the way. Like someone sleeps in the bed of the truck. Yeah. The ladies rest. Room is a modern.
This guy is like, you know, the 10-year-old with the race car bed. Yep. Who never grew out of it.
I was thinking a little bit of that mixed with the scene in Big where he starts making money and he turns his loft into like
a pinball machine
and they're skateboarding or whatever. It's just like, I'm a big guy with a little kid brain and big people money, and I just want to make a castle all day.
And this Zoltar machine.
And a Zoltar machine. And who's going to stop me? God? No.
God. Zoltar destroyed God. Yeah. Zoltar is God.
I sold my soul to become big, and no God. I was not in God's light then.
I went to the crossroads and I heard, give me a quarter and I'll tell you your fortune.
I want to be old and get a job. Yeah, all right. Now? You can just wait. Like I was saying, the ladies' restroom is a modernized outhouse with carpeting on the walls and ceiling to make it more feminine. There's a treehouse in the branches of a 400-year-old live oak tree, complete with a swimming pool, which just means there's a 12-foot deep, 10-foot in diameter oil tank.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
This place doesn't sound stable. Like, I'm surprised it is not collapsed or condemned. Okay.
Never collapsed.
Okay.
Never even shook a little bit during all the earthquakes. Huh. It is completely stable. And
weird.
I don't know how. And I don't think anyone who built it knows how either.
Ask Zoltar.
Wish number two.
Hail Zoltar.
Rubel has two giant natural gas engines that he used to pump water to irrigate with. He used a huge engine to turn into a barbecue pit. Another 14-ton engine is used as a bird bath. And also next to the Tin Palace is a 1909 windmill that operates the washing machine. A little bit Green Acres-y.
Yeah, this sounds like a society in The Walking Dead.
I was a little bit, when I was looking at different angles of it, I'm like, this is what people in Mad Max do.
Yeah.
They build a structure out of trash and they're like, we're oil safe. Let me tell you, it's not.
I'm going to harness the power of wind to shuck all this corn for me, which is how we will survive.
And then the marauders beat you to death with your own leg.
Yeah. And then they turn your place into like a giant sex palace of disgusting proportion.
Yeah. And as cool and visionary and kooky and Venice Canals as this place is, look up pictures of the place. What's truly astounding is its creation, which ended in 1986, 21 years after Rubel started it. It took 21 years to build it to the point where he's like, we're done. We got everything.
Hey, at least he knew what to call it, not like the Watts Towers.
I agree with that, that you can look at something and be like, I almost admire that.
It's done.
But like he said in an interview, like the castle was his fun hobby project. He worked hard at it, but it had no formal purpose, no deadlines, no bosses. It was a big wild dream by somebody who liked to build forts as a kid. The castle isn't necessarily fun. The building of the castle was fun.
Yeah, this is a little kid.
He's a little kid, yeah.
He's definitely Zoltard.
He's got like Spud and Rich energy too. Like growing up in San Gabriel Valley and sort of being like, I just wanted like to have fun, like fun things and not job. I want not job.
Yeah. I just want to buy a bunch of land and then somehow afford it all.
Yeah. And the kindness of everybody around here.
The taxes will be paid by kindness.
And he did, like I meant to say, he did not do this alone. Over two decades, thousands of friends and volunteers put time and effort into constructing the place. And they were known, like I said, they were known as farmhands, farm with a PH. And many of them lived, crashed, partied, relaxed here at Rubel Castle. It was their space to do whatever they wanted with because they helped build it. That was Michael Rubel's thing. The term Rubelian gets tossed around to in terms of the aesthetic and the bohemian lifestyle. And the lifestyle is like repurposing items others would deem as vintage junk. And he would breathe new life into junk, trash, the literal monument to trash treasure.
There was an epidemic that broke out there. It was called Rubella.
Thank you.
No cure.
No cure.
No cure.
Endless bodies. Michael Rubel passed away in 2007, but before he died, he gifted the castle to the Glendora Historical Society. His nephew, Scott Rubel, is helping to preserve the lot as well. Some of the spaces are being used as living quarters, and it has residents, and the residents are either the caretakers who helped build it or people who knew or relatives of people who originally built the castle. It's not really like a place that's really open to the public. They offer tours, but like it almost feels like... Crosspoints of the World, or Crossroads of the World, where it's like a now contained space, and you're, you know,
a few businesses
that are lucky enough to get space there. Glendale Historical Society now kind of runs and operates it. 2013.
Glendale or Glendora?
Glendora. No, we got it too. Yeah.
Mind your boundaries, Glendale.
In October of 2013, the Rubel Castle Historical District was listed in the National Register of Historic Places, which is great. You could take a tour of Rubel Castle, but you have to message the Glendora Historical Society ahead of time because it really isn't open to the public. They have to figure that thing out. Tours are $20, and I imagine well worth it. And I heard from someone that it's a lot of walking, so look out for that. And that's Rubel Castle.
I don't do walking anymore.
I don't care about getting my steps in.
Yeah, I'm not about that.
I don't bother with that anymore.
That I feel like there's a few castles scattered around Los Angeles.
I would like to explore all the weird folk art.
Storm the castles.
I like to storm the castles. I like to visit all the weird folk art stuff we have here in Southern California. I know there's a lot.
I think there's a castle restaurant, that is shaped like a castle somewhere in like the hills of Malibu. And then I think there's another one also by that lake where there was the lake monster in Santa Clarita.
Oh, right.
But it's like, these are both like biker places though.
Oh,
so, you know.
Yeah. You
know. Yeah. Well, hey everybody, do you have soy on the menu? it's a weird phenomenon that there's more than one castle in Los Angeles.
Really, we're kooky people out here in California. We do things a little bit differently.
Yeah, we have our own little kingdoms broken off from the law.
Yeah, and you can't charge me taxes because I built my own society.
Because Zoltar said so.
Yeah, Zoltar said so, and he's gonna come for you.
So now we've got one more dust covered item to shake out of this junk drawer today.
One more tale of the weird.
Another tale of men gone mad. Men gone wild. My favorite late night commercial for tapes I could buy. Men gone wild in Miami.
In Miami.
Interestingly enough, this is also a story about a house, this next one. So.
A guy with certain initials as a first name.
It's not so much of a house as a castle.
A castle. Monument of death.
Ostensibly a hotel, but the press deemed it a pit of hell. So now this one. Sumter. Knox. MacArthur. The bunch of pillows and sheets on your living room floor during a sleepover. These are all famous forts. But there's one more.
What about Harrison?
Harrison Ford. He was born in April Fool's Day, right? Harrison Ford. There's one more famous fort here in Los Angeles worth noting, and that is Fort Anthony. Do you know about this?
No.
So we got forts, castles, and pirates.
Yeah, forts, castle, and pirates, all in this episode of Ally McLeay, True Detective.
Seasons 1-4. So
one through four. Go ahead, sorry.
A thrilling and sensational story. But first, it begins with the story of how a museum is born.
Oh, my favorite thing. We should put this in a room.
Of course, the museum we're talking about here is the Museum of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
Ah.
Open in 2021. That's not the one we're talking about.
No?
That's not the one we're talking about. I read my own notes wrong. That is not the one we're talking about. Abort. Okay. Abort. A fort. We had that one, but the first calls for there to be a museum of movies in Los Angeles started in 1917, which, what are they going to have? In the D.W. Griffith's lunch from the day before? What movie history could possibly have been in 1917?
Oh my God, what's his name? Not Fat Albert. What's the silent movie star's name?
Yeah, Fat Albert.
What's his name?
Oh, the Junkyard Gang?
The big
Fatty
guy.
Fatty Arbuckle?
Fatty Arbuckle.
Hey, I didn't kill that lady.
Hey, you're not supposed to be able to hear me talk. As soon as Fatty Arbuckle's done shooting, like, give me the hat. We got to put it in the museum.
Yeah. Can you also take this gun? Allegedly. But other serious to half serious proposals popped up over the decades following this for movie museums. There was one proposed in Culver City. There actually was a small movie museum opened on the USC campus in 1928.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In the 40s, they considered building one on the site of the Cafe Trocadero on Sunset when it closed.
Okay.
There was an idea to put one where the original Warner Brothers studio was on Sunset, but it wasn't until the mid-50s that the first credible proposal started floating around.
Okay.
Credible because this one was going to be run by the county of Los Angeles and had actual powerful names in show business and government attached to it. I wrote showbiz. That was just shorthand in my notes. That means show business. That's why I said that a little weird.
For the layman out there.
And for government, I wrote, you know, Putin's government. That just means government to you people. So this was the Los Angeles County Hollywood Museum, or later the Hollywood Motion Picture and Television Museum. Mm-hmm. And the formal process to get work started on this began in 1959, designed by our old pal, William Pereira.
Oh, right.
It wasn't just going to be a dusty old movie museum. It was going to be the Disneyland of movies.
Okay.
Let me guide you through this Wonka-esque experience that almost was.
Okay.
First, you'd buy your tickets from an animatronic Clark Gable or Marlena Dietrich or someone else of that ilk. So you'd go up to, frankly, my dear, I don't give change.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give group rates. And whatever Marlena Dietrich said, I don't remember. My knowledge is limited.
Why don't you come up and use a Groupon sometime? No, that wasn't her. How about we have the animatronic Fatty Arbuckle out here? He can really work a crowd. He can really work a gun also, but...
Did not shoot anybody. Absolutely did not shoot a person.
Oh, yeah. I guess it was something else he did. I retract my jokes from before. Then you'd walk into a four-story high forest containing exhibits on the history of film and artifacts from classic movies. Then you'd get into an elevator that took you to a recreation of an ancient Roman street with more exhibits and more artifacts, not Roman artifacts.
Yeah, this harkens back to a time when they made movies in Rome.
Oh, and they don't now? You're not excited to see Joaquin Phoenix is Caligula coming to theaters? From there, there would be even more exhibit space set inside of various movie set recreations, including the full actual recreated sets of various classic movies would be in here that you could walk through.
Oh, cool.
There were also going to be glass booths you could walk into that would overlook two active sound stages that they would rent out to studios to film actual movies. So you could stand above and watch Marlena Dietrich say her signature line.
Yeah, which we all know, and we don't even need to say it again.
Why don't you come down and see me sometime? Again, I'm pretty sure that's not, I think that's Betty Davis.
That's Mae West.
Mae West. Mae West. The other one.
Yeah. You can look down while they're filming a movie and call TMZ on a rotary phone and be like, I know exactly what Marvel movie they're shooting today.
Hang on. Clara, can you get me TMZ 555? Yeah, Harvey? You won't believe who I just saw taking tickets in front of the museum.
Drunk as a skunk. When I did the snap in front of his eyes, did not move.
Sparks flying off of him.
Yeah.
Watch these two. The sparks will fly. And if they do, call 911. Please call the fire department. So there would be an academic library and film vaults and a 600-seat theater to screen movies in, 800 parking spots.
Now you're speaking my language.
And of course, a full recreation of the Hollywood canteen that you could eat your lunch or dinner.
Wow. In.
And also they had Clark Gable there and he would say, frankly, my dear, I don't give a ham. I've had that in my back pocket for like 2 minutes now.
How am I going to pull this off?
How am I going to
put this in? How am I going to land there?
The facts I gave you were true. Clark Gable did not say that, though. It was Turkey. So as the plans and the ambition grew, this museum expanded to also cover not only movies, but also radio, television, and music.
Cool.
So it was just the new arts is what it was going to cover. And the location for this. Across the street from the Hollywood Bowl, where the Lasky Barn now is on Highland.
Got it.
Just to make sure traffic there was as bad as possible by the laws of physics. Whatever else we can cram in here. Let's also put a hospital.
Let's put a hospital right there. Let's see if we can...
And a police station.
Yeah, let's see if we can start the tram tours here for Universal Studios. Maybe they can pick up here.
Yeah, we're willing to rent out the little space we do have left to parking for Disneyland.
Yeah, and then this turn lane here, I think we're going to have a farmer's market.
Every day.
Every day.
24/7. So not only that, big time supporter of this and head freezing, Walt Disney planned to move CalArts pretty much where the Ford Theater is to help turn that whole area into a mega campus of sorts for CalArts. So it was
that is the also the original, like around there is what Whitley Heights, the original Hollywood area, right?
Well, kind of this might be where that story is kind of going.
Okay.
But it was sort of going to be like a cultural, you know, the Hollywood Bowl, CalArts, and this museum. That was going to be, and then you got the valley right there. Great, you got the valley right there. And then Monkey Island is just
right
the
around the corner as a threat. On the Spanish ships are closing in on Mexico.
It was estimated to cost $6.5 million, and many celebrities and rich people already pledged millions of their own dollars to pay for the startup costs. And that And then once it was set up, it was going to be run by the county with continuing costs paid for through taxes and also donations.
Okay.
On June 1st, 1960, the city approved the 4.5 acres of land it was going to be on, and it was officially approved for construction by Governor Edmund Brown in April 1961. Cecil B. DeMille, Jesse Lasky, Carl Lemley, Mary Pickford, and many others pledged to donate their full collection of Hollywood memorabilia to the museum. But in a sign of the things to come, it wasn't until October 1963 that they had a groundbreaking ceremony.
Okay.
Not just like, this is an innovative ceremony. They broke the ground.
They broke the
ground. This is a ceremony.
Clark Gable, jackhammer, summer day.
Frankly, my dear.
I don't give a ham.
I don't give a slam. And the earth shook. His whole career can be condensed into that one movie,
a star of many great films.
So 6,000 people were in attendance, including Ice Cube Head himself, Walt Disney, mm-hmm. Jimmy Stewart, Gene Autry,
ooh.
Gregory Peck,
ooh.
Mary Pickford, mm-hmm. Gloria Swanson, mm. Ramon Navarro, mm-hmm. and a bunch of nobodies, and 5,990 nobodies. They broke the ground just fine, but there was one thing that they could not break, an ex-Marine who couldn't afford to move anywhere else, Stephen Anthony. Like I said, former Marine, current bartender at Barney's Beanery.
Okay.
He was 33, but looked 57, and he lived at 6655 Alta Loma Terrace, which was about where Fairfield and Odin is right now next to the barn. I drove by this today.
Uh-huh.
It's like you were talking about. This was a neighborhood. There was one holdout. He lived there at this address with his wife and kids. The house itself was a really nice little cottage type house built in 1923 that was actually owned by and built for a producer named Gordon Pollock, who years before this had rented it to Betty Davis. This was her first house in Hollywood.
Wow, really?
Pollock was
that's a big deal.
That's a big deal. And she was like obsessed with, like, she wrote about this house in her biography. Like, she loved this house.
Yeah.
Pollock was now Anthony's landlord. And in something unfathomable to me, he was actually friends with his landlord and helped him out with things. So when Pollock and his wife both died in a plane crash,
wow.
It turned out that he had actually willed the house to Anthony.
Okay.
That whole area was covered with little cottage houses like this one. But to make room for the coming museum, everyone else was paid to move by the city and the homes were bulldozed under eminent domain. Except Stephen Anthony's house.
He owned it?
They all owned the houses. Oh, okay. The city bought them all out.
But not, he didn't.
He said, I'm not leaving.
Yeah.
In a much too relatable situation for me, the city had offered him money to move, but he had refused, saying that it wasn't enough money to find a reasonably comparable house to the one he already owned.
Yes.
The city could not disagree more. The amount that he was offered was $11,750, which today is about $120,000, which back then maybe was enough. But he said that there were a lot of back taxes on the house he had inherited. So after all that was paid off, it would only actually be $3,000 that he was getting from this. So, of course, the city started the process of forcibly evicting him.
Wow.
But evictions take a long time, and Anthony was fighting it hard in court for 2 years. He argued his point about it not being enough money. He said his daughter was too sick to be moved to a new house. Mm-hmm. He said the house was a historic landmark. His lawyers said the county had no claim to his land because the museum was partially a private entity. None of these were working. No angle was working.
It's strange because it's one of the greatest movie stars of all time's home. You'd think that they would work that into the museum.
Design it into the building.
Into the building.
But he still lives in it.
Yeah.
But he has to pay admission every day. You got to go up to Clark Gable.
They get like a local residence discount.
Yeah. SoCal resident.
SoCal resident discount.
Yeah. You also get a ticket to Cal Arts. So every appeal was rejected. And according to the law, Anthony and his family had to move. And the situation was getting dire because there hadn't been no further construction in those 2 years since the groundbreaking because of his house.
Yeah.
They couldn't get rid of this house, and the money people behind this needed the project to get moving or else it was going to be dead in the water, much like the people from my other story. So those are the two sides that took us to February 8th, 1964.
Okay.
The day before the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan.
Oh my God.
And just to preface this guy, you know, when I was reading about this, there were a lot of, I guess you could say dog whistles.
Okay.
Or like red flags and dog whistles where I was like, this guy, I admire what he's doing, mm-hmm. that he didn't give up, because I've been in a situation like that.
Sure.
And I understand. But there were a lot of things that I was like, something feels kind of gross about this. And as the story goes on, it is kind of gross.
He had a swastika for a head. Yeah. He was like a living swastika.
He walked on one flat leg.
He's always reaching for something. His arm was...
kind of walking like an Egyptian, but scarier. Okay, so the day before the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, yeah. February 8th, 1964.
How did it go for them? How did they do?
Bombed. Big time bomb. People only tore apart 17 seats.
Only two girls wet their pants.
Only four parents got trampled and sent to the hospital. So that's the day, February 8th, 1964, at the time, 7:30 a.m., the Beatles were just going to bed from the night before. Sheriff's department cars surround Stephen Anthony's house, and out come 12 deputies armed with tear gas prepared to forcibly evict Anthony and his family from the house, Chavez Ravine style. Mm-hmm. Inside was Anthony, his 22-year-old wife, Alona, their three kids, the oldest of which was 2.5 somehow, Alona's 14-year-old sister, and their parents, Alona and her sister's parents. When the deputies approached, they noticed something in the upstairs window. It was Anthony holding his baby in one arm and a 12-gauge shotgun in the other.
Oh, my God. That's not the bottle. You mix up the bottle and the gun, pal.
Come on. Burp. You come, burp. And they all knew this was not going to go according to plan. The deputies told him he needed to leave. He responded by threatening to shoot anyone who launched tear gas into their house.
Okay.
He said, "I'm perfectly willing to die for this. A man has to die for something he believes in." All too familiar for me.
Yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like,
I agree with that.
I agree with your fight. I don't agree with your methods.
No, absolutely not. But he tried the legal way.
He did try the legal way. And now I'm going to shoot you or throw a baby at you.
Yeah.
So, of course, this meant that the press immediately descended on the scene. Yeah. Then came the looky-loos, and suddenly the standoff was being broadcast live on TV, and the house was being dubbed Fort Anthony. Surprisingly, the deputies weren't willing to gas a bunch of children and elderly people, so they didn't want to do anything, but Anthony also was not going to give his house up.
Yeah.
He had made that perfectly clear. Like I'm saying, this was, especially today, very relatable of like, I'm not leaving, I have a house. I'm not letting the city, the county take this away from me. His priest was brought into the house to try to convince him to come to his senses. He failed.
Yeah.
This went on for 7 hours, and then miraculously, the county stood down and gave him a 1-week extension on the eviction to give him time to file his appeal to the California Supreme Court.
Oh my gosh.
Once this was made official, he actually let the press and deputies into the house and showed them all the gun wasn't actually loaded.
Great.
It was at first, but his father-in-law made him take the bullets out because he would 100% have killed somebody otherwise.
Yeah.
That Monday, 12 fellow ex-Marines announced they were joining Anthony at the house to defend it in case the cops came back. Anthony said he told, see, this is one of the many red flags and dog whistles, like, oh, so now a militia's forming. Anthony said he told the Marines not to bring guns, but ultimately the decision was up to them. The next day, the LA County Board of Supervisors had an emergency vote to reevaluate the eviction, fearing a bloodbath.
There's no way at this point, even cops and press there at the scene of the original showdown, there's no way that the Academy should go forward with this plan.
You that, think that? Hey, they insisted on having the Oscars like 4 months into the pandemic. The Academy will move forward anything except nominating movies about black people.
Hey, Green Book won, right?
Hey, La La Land almost won, and then we gave it to Moonlight. My eyes see La La Land. So
why is he like this?
So Kenneth Hahn had to remind everybody, let's remember, we're just building a motion picture museum.
Yeah.
Like he was everybody calm down.
Yeah.
But there was so much, there were millions of dollars behind this. So like a little bit of bloodshed isn't going to stop the county at this point. And Mary Pickford.
She wants what she wants.
Send Gene Autry in. So luckily, he got the appeal to the California Supreme Court, so the county couldn't touch him until they made their decision. So for now, he was safe. And suddenly, he became a folk hero.
Yeah.
This story spread across the nation, and Anthony was painted as a lone David standing against big Goliath government.
You know what I love about folk heroes? You just have to do a little bit more research.
Yeah.
And they're not folk heroes anymore.
Yeah. Today's folk hero is tomorrow's tiki holding Charlottesville marching.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting. But people on the street started raising money for his legal fees.
Uh-huh.
The young Republicans held support rallies for him. Again, big red flag.
Yeah.
The House became a tourist attraction. Like okay. people wanted to see. Anthony really let it go to his head and started calling his house Fort Anthony, colon, outpost of the battle for freedom from government tyranny.
God, you can use like four less words, first of all.
Stop it at Fort.
Yeah.
Even Anthony's pushing it.
Fort Anthony, the greatest story ever told.
Fort Anthony, make Highland Avenue great again.
You
know, it's hard to disagree. Like I keep saying, it's hard to disagree with his sentiment of I want to keep my house.
Yeah.
But like, don't turn it into it's not this.
No.
The county, on the other hand, felt that he was just trying to suck more money out of them. But you know what? Here's the thing about all this. He's right.
Yeah.
He's doing it the wrong way. The city's wrong.
Also not doing a great job.
The city's, you know what the city could do? Give him more money.
Yeah.
Like,
that's the problem. You're not giving me enough money, and that's okay. The Academy.
Yes. Mary Pickford could say, guess what? Here's $50,000 over.
We'll help you find a place too.
You can live at Pickfair.
Yeah.
We won't even notice. But it's
I'm never there.
If you can tolerate my husband jogging naked every morning, God knows I can't. But it's just so easy of like how much money. The county has so much money.
Yeah.
Look at you know how much money they probably spent on 12 sheriff's deputies surrounding this house with tear gas.
Yep.
So much money they could have given him. So many of these celebrities could, this all could have, like, just give him more money. Mm-hmm. Like, he's clearly putting up enough fuss, even if he doesn't really mean it.
Yeah.
Just give him the
money. Just give him the money. Yeah.
But that's not what happened. 3 weeks later, the verdict came in from the California Supreme Court. Anthony had to evacuate the house. The county gave him 48 hours to do so. He responded thusly, I'm not leaving.
Yeah, you know, I figured. I kind of could take a guess that you were. Please. That's the county. Please, come on, do it. Please.
Oh, but we don't have any more money. Oh, but we're going to send this RoboCop in too. We just bought him.
We're going to parachute a psychopath into your yard and murder your family.
We're going to raise the corpse of Mad Jack Morgan. So now it's March 1st. Anthony had sent his family to stay with some relatives in Burbank for fear of what might happen. So it was just him and a dozen Marines holding down the fort. Mm-hmm. The press and looky-loos were also there. The only ones who weren't there were the cops. So they waited and waited and waited for days.
Wow.
They waited. No cops ever showed up.
Okay.
There was no communication and no explanation to Anthony of what was going on. Both sides were clearly hesitant to make the first move, but Anthony knew the county was plotting something. So he took this opportunity to petition his case to the United States Supreme Court, which extended his sanctuary time. Still with no word from the county. But this was as high up as Anthony could take his case. And he knew that. He even said that if the U.S. Supreme Court said, you lose, he would leave peacefully because he was a good American. And that would be the final word. And then came the final word. On March 30th, the U.S. Supreme Court would not hear his case. So Anthony, true to his word, bought more ammo and refused to leave.
Wow.
So now even more Marines joined him in the house. He sent his family away again, and the stage was set for a final showdown with his 300 rounds of ammo at the ready and a army of Marines, a small army of Marines.
Odin and Highland?
Yeah, it's where it's if you're taking the bus to get to the Hollywood Bowl, you're going to drive by where all this happened.
That's insane.
And again, he waited and waited and waited, and no cop showed up. Something very weird was going on, but he did not know what it was.
Yeah.
After a week of waiting, he needed to get out of the house. So he left his lawyer, Leonidas P. Ekonom, in charge of the house, and he went to go to church, but still, nobody came. And then came April 13th, 1964, the night of the 36th Academy Awards, what beautiful irony. The Marines had mostly lost interest and left. So inside the house was Anthony, his lawyer, again, whose name is Leonidas P. Ekonom, and a friend of his named Pamela Anderson, not that one.
What?
Yeah. And his lawyer, his lawyer's actually, his real name was Atticus Finch, not that one. So they were all watching the Oscars when someone knocked at the door. Pamela Anderson went to answer the door. And standing there were Len Herendine and Kurt Brubaker, who were two of the young Republicans who were holding fundraisers for Anthony. Oscar party, here we come. They come inside, and then Brubaker committed an Oscar party faux pas and stood right in front of the TV. And he said to Anthony, he stood over him and he said, you ever seen a pair of these? And he dangled a pair of handcuffs in front of him, to which Anthony responded, oh no.
Oh my God.
So he jumped out of his chair, but Brubaker punched him so hard, he flew back down into his rocking chair and shattered it to pieces. Herendeen then opened the door and 30 of the 100 deputies who had been hiding around the house rushed inside. It took 3 cops to physically subdue Anthony and he was finally put in handcuffs and everyone inside was held at gunpoint.
Wow.
The county had played.
But I want to see if Vertigo wins.
I want to see who gets slapped this time. Please wait until the in memoriam. The county had played the long con, and these two young Republicans had been double agents the entire time. Anthony was led from the house and charged with battery, resisting arrest, and most importantly, not paying a ticket for making an illegal left turn in Beverly Hills 6 years earlier. So that's what they got. That's what they got him on.
He's getting the electric chair now.
They're sending it to Cable's
gonna, Mary Pickford's going to pull the switch.
So they're going to have the animatronic Clark Gable come in. That's how they power him on. Frankly, my dear.
I don't give a zap. I don't know.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a kablam. So the second they were all removed from the house, a crew fenced off the property, and the next morning they removed all their belongings from the property, including their neighbor's dog by accident.
What?
And Fort Anthony was bulldozed that day.
My God.
Anthony fought the law, and the law won. He ended up spending 6 months in jail and sued the county many times afterwards for what happened. He later said, "We had to fight the system, otherwise they'd take anything they want under eminent domain. We were harassed, just like in a communist country."
Mm.
Yeah. Is that a red flag?
It's like 95% I'm with you, pal. Yeah. And then 5% like,
This guy should have been a silent hero. So he also had planned to later sue the county for destroying something he claims was left in the house by the original owner that was a formula to perfect 3D movie processing. He said that was lost to time. Too bad. We could have had the perfect Avatar experience. Eventually, Anthony and his family left LA and moved to Sonora, California in 1971, where he became a house builder rather than a house defender. But all this was worth it because we now have a beautiful 60-year-old movie museum on that spot. What's that? We don't. That's because the whole project fell apart the next year. The negative press surrounding this incident slowed things down, and while maybe not killed it, it certainly didn't help.
Yeah.
What really did it in, though, was that the museum just got too big to sustain itself and they could never get enough funding to catch up with their plans. But we do have that barn that was moved there in the 80s. So grab your baby and your shotgun because we're going squatting in that barn.
Well, grab 12 of your best Marine friends and head over.
Yeah, it's this is a weird.
Yeah, the two stories I had not even a single thought about either one of them.
It's just such a shame that somebody who was fighting the county in a good way, you know, like so many people lost their homes for the freeways and stuff like it was and Chavez Ravine and all that, you know, it's a noble fight. But like, why do you have to say that we're in a communist country and bring the Young Republic? Mm. The Young Republicans did this to you.
They're on you. OK, they're not on your side. Yeah. It goes to show that in L.A., it's almost like land and property were always the gold.
Yeah.
It's the most coveted thing. And especially, I mean, it feels like that right now. Like if you can get a home or just a space, never give it up.
If you can squat inside some abandoned building, never give that up.
Never give that spot up.
I
kill for it.
Kill Errol Flynn if you have to. If you drive, because like I said, I drove past that spot earlier today and there's still houses above that area. So you can still kind of tell that must have been a really nice place to live.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I've seen pictures of the house. It's a really nice old house. Mm-hmm. I don't blame him.
Yeah.
I don't blame him. I would not have pulled a gun. When I was being told move and we'll give you money, I did not pull a gun on anybody.
Yeah, sure.
I pulled everything else on them, but not a gun.
Yeah, not a gun.
Because I don't own a gun.
I loaded my cannon. Not the same thing.
A bazooka isn't a gun. and it really amounted to nothing, all of it.
It's wild. Wild that all of that fuss and it's just a parking lot now.
Yeah, it's an overflow parking lot.
Yeah, it's an overflow parking lot.
And a museum that's open for like 2 hours a month.
Not even consecutive hours.
No,
it's 45 minutes here. Yeah, 20 minutes here. 45 minutes here.
It's weird tale. Weird and wild tales from this episode of True Detective Los Angeles season 2. So that's some junk stories from our junk drawer. Good stories from the junk drawer.
Good stories. Places to visit.
Now, let's have a pre-listener question plug before we get to that. I'm going to. Hey, you know what? You've all got friends. I know you all have friends.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you tell people you have friends, But if you really do have friends, like four of you might, tell them, if they love LA history, tell them to listen to our show.
Yeah.
Spread the word orally. Make this as contagious as rubella.
No paper trail.
No paper trail. Do not
write our
names
down.
And if you happen to write our names down on a new paper, swallow it immediately and go to the vet.
Yeah. And if somebody looks at it and this says Ellie Meekly on a post-it, you all have a cyanide tooth.
You have 10 days.
You have 10 days. they'll torture you.
You all have a cyanide. Yeah. If you're a member of our Patreon, we already installed your cyanide tooth without you knowing in your sleep.
Ellie Meekly brand cyanide tooth.
Fast acting. Fast acting, painful killing. But so tell your LA history loving friend to give LA Meekly a try.
Yeah, give it a listen.
Now we have a listener question.
Oh boy.
By from our loyal soldier, Dan O'Keefe.
Willing to do anything for us.
Yeah, if we need to defend ourselves from the county, he will be the first Marine there.
He'd be the baby in our arms.
He'd be the baby and the shotgun. So he asked us, if you could turn the Boyle Heights Sears building into anything through reuse or demolition, what would it be? I don't know that much about it. I know what it looks like. This is a big abandoned building.
A big, beautiful abandoned building. Yeah. Beautiful Art Deco. Neon. Yeah, Art Deco.
That says Sears on it.
Yeah. You know, whatever the residents of Boyle Heights need, if they need it to be, you know, it should be up to them.
It's theirs.
Oh, yeah. Whole Foods, a Trader Joe's, if they need to be a hardware store, if they need whatever they need it to be, it should be that for the community.
Let's turn this old Sears building into a Gimbals.
The last Gimbals on Earth.
Gimbals. The best little Gimbals in South LA.
It should definitely. Boyle Heights. East LA can suck.
East LA.
Yeah. they can get their own Sears. East LA has the Dracula CVS. Let Boyle Heights have the Art Deco Sears, because you have the Dracula CVS.
This can be Frankenstein Sears.
Yeah.
So you say what you say, put it to a vote.
Put it to a vote, whatever Boyle Heights needs. I mean, as long as it stands and, you know, stays in operation, it's a beautiful building. It's a piece of our history. We're losing so much pieces of history.
Yeah, we don't want demolition. We don't want this to turn into Fort Anthony, because I will be there.
I will be
there. With Dan O'Keefe in my arms.
Two babies in my arms. I forgot the gun.
Dan O'Keefe and his twin.
Yeah. Jan O'Keefe.
Dan P. Keefe.
You know, the other fear is like, oh, it's become lofts for artists who are rich because their parents are doctors and they move here. Mm-hmm. That's not a knock against people, it's just doctors.
Yeah, doctors suck.
Doctors
don't
suck. Bring back medicine, men. I think it belongs to Boyle Heights. They should take a vote and see what should be done with it.
Well, my responsible answer is affordable housing.
Yes, of course.
I've always wanted to live in a department store. So, but my fun answer is, so it says Sears on the top, right?
Uh-huh. All right. You've already lost me.
I'm in.
Yeah.
Mary Pickford gave me $10 million already.
Rearrange the words. It says arse.
So it says Sears on the top already. Here's my fun proposition for this place. Turn it into a series of restaurants that all sear your food.
Oh my God.
So you go to each department and there's like different types of food. Like, this is the tofu department. This is the beef department. Uh-huh. This is the cheese department. And all of your food gets seared.
Oh my God.
Each department.
Jesus Christ. Your Willy Wonka vision.
For Sears. I'm the Willy Wonka of Sears.
It's not hard to add a letter to a neon sign. You just like, you know.
It's on the budget, though.
It can be an entire building dedicated to gardening scissors.
Searsers?
Shears.
Shears. Oh, okay, there we go. It could be Sears.
Dis-a-Sears.
And it's like a magician's hideout. Dis-a-Sears. Nobody knows what goes on in there.
When you disappear in a trick, you end up in Dis-a-Sears. It's a temporary holding place in between tricks.
This is where all of the people who get called up from the audience in Las Vegas get teleported to. And if they're hungry while they're there,
little snacks laid out for everybody.
Yeah, and if you want this piece of meat, go up to the.
No, it's not burned enough.
Just seared, just
a little bit more.
But yeah, that's your answer, Dan O'Keefe.
Yeah, there's the answer to your really good question.
Yeah, one non-answer and one ridiculous, stupid answer.
What one Looney Tunes answer?
But now
Porky Pig had a building.
Now, I mean, the idea of Dis-a-Sears, I want to make. I'm going to start going to every city council meeting. Could we once again discuss the motion about dis a Sears in Boyle Heights?
Why are you dressed like a Trojan? Because this is Sears. And you kick somebody into a hole.
I kick Kevin DeLeon into a giant hole. And everyone applauds.
The city, yeah, the city claps.
Everyone applauds and then re-elects him.
They re-elect the hole. They elect the hole, sorry. They elect the hole.
Yeah, please. He's a first time. He's not an incumbent.
He's in the Brave New Hope.
So, yeah, that's our spring cleaning junk drawer episode.
Yeah.
We'll see you in May.
Haunted May. Where I'll make all of your happiness disappear.
May slay.
Yeah, enjoy April. The weather is getting, yeah, enjoy tax season. The weather is getting nice.
Nice. Some would dare would say nice.
And there's pollen in the air. I saw a tree blow. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah, bye.
I saw a tree blow that had so much pollen flying off of it, I thought it was on fire.
Wow.
So get ready for that. Yeah. We've had a lot of rain this winter, so get ready for allergy season.
I've got a Claritin D in my pocket right now.
Is that a Claritin D in your pocket, or are you...
Or my eyes watering, because my allergies hit me so hard.
Are you going into anaphylactic shock? So that's been yet another episode of LA Meekly.
Making H.H. Holmes victims disappear since 2013.
That should be H.H. Holmes's new castle. I mean, yeah. He is the devil, so he's reincarnated. So he's here. He does walk among us.
And he's very interested in real estate.
And this time, the insurance fraud covers real estate. H.H. Holmes.
I need a body to throw off a building and pretend it was me, H.H. Holmes.
Played by Timothy Chalamet.
He can play anything.